from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yale economist Ray Fair is prepared to make a few predictions, scientific predictions, he says, on who will be unfaithful in marriage, what interest rates will be, and whether George Bush or John Kerry will win in November. Tonight on Point, predicting the future the scientific way. But first, we begin tonight in Iraq, where, amid fierce fighting, radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr today called for a nationwide uprising against U.S. and coalition forces. I spoke earlier with Scott Baldoff, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor in Najaf, which saw the worst of today's fighting. I asked him if the American truce brokered with al-Sadr in May has now collapsed.
If it hasn't collapsed yet, it is well on its way in that direction. There were some initial indications that it was heading that direction earlier this week when a U.S. Marine patrol ventured into a neighborhood controlled by Muqtada al-Sadr in an area where Muqtada al-Sadr had his office. A battle ensued, but then the Americans pulled back and said, oops, we stumbled on here on this place. And they didn't actually apologize. Later this week, of course, we started hearing from members of Muqtada al-Sadr's fighters, some of the political agents there in Baghdad, were saying, look, this is a provocation and we will respond. And sure enough, around just after midnight this morning, there was apparently a raid on police stations by the Mehdi army, which is the group that Muqtada al-Sadr controls. These groups overran two police stations and did not overrun a third. U.S. troops were called in, U.S. Marines were called in to support the Iraqi police, and that's when it all began. We had very heavy fighting when we arrived early this morning with a very strong response by American troops in Humvees, in Bradley fighting machines, and also in helicopter gunships overhead. And the fighters, the Mehdi Army fighters on the ground, were zipping around in private cars, setting up mortar, firing and lobbing it into U.S. or Iraqi positions, and then moving on very quickly. It was a very, very tough fight, and a lot of civilians were injured and some killed.
Scott, we're reading reports at this hour of one U.S. soldier dead, five wounded. A helicopter came down, its crew rescued but wounded. The U.S. military saying seven insurgents killed, 22 wounded, and signs of tension in large swaths of Iraq. Very high tension, we're told, in Baghdad and Basra. Of course, yesterday there was the big fighting in Mosul in the north, the biggest since the U.S. invasion up in that area. Last fall, when Muqtada al-Sadr called for a national uprising, it amounted to not much. In April, when he called for a national uprising, it seemed on the verge of tearing Iraq to pieces. How is the country situated now? Is it at risk of coming apart at the seams again?
Well, Muqtada al-Sadr's popularity has increased with those young, particularly young Iraqi Shias, who want to see some action. These are people who want to exercise their new muscle. They claim to have something like 60% of the population and would like to start asserting themselves and to reverse a lot of the discrimination that happened under the Saddam Hussein regime. The top leadership, though, of the Shia faith here in Iraq have not been very kind to Muqtada al-Sadr. They see him as a lowly cleric who really should know his place. And the older, supposedly wiser Shia clerics are saying, we need to only be fighting against the Americans if there's some benefit to the Iraqi people, and particularly to the Shias. You should only take up a resistance if you have a chance of winning. But, you know, the momentum does appear to be on the side of Muqtada al-Sadr. He has been getting, apparently, more and more fighters. They have been taking credit, at least, for doing a lot of civil works projects in a Shia neighborhood of Baghdad named after Muqtada al-Sadr's father.
It's Sadr City.
That's right, Sadr City. So it seems to be that the momentum is on his side suddenly, and this is a larger problem, at least, than it appears the U.S. Was bargaining for.
Muqtada al-Sadr saying in his statement from Najaf, fight the blasphemous, fight the Americans. What does this portend, Scott, for American hopes of getting more U.S. soldiers out of Iraq and turning over security to Iraqi forces?
clearly, if the U.S. forces had not been here in Najaf to support the Iraqi troops, to support them from the skies and on the ground with heavy machinery, I don't think that that the battle would have ended up the same way. As it appears now, several police stations that may have been overrun by the Mahdi army have returned to government hands, although that could change again overnight. So if there really is a desire to see a government that is beholden to the regime of Ayad Alawi, the new leader of Iraq, there's going to need to be U.S. troops here, at least for the short term. Long term, it's another issue. You really have to build up the capacity of Iraq to defend itself.
And Scott, finally, you've taken refuge in a private home there in Najaf. You were there through the fighting today. What are you hearing from Iraqis, maybe the ones you've taken shelter with? What's their attitude toward all this fighting?
Well, surprisingly, there is a lot of criticism for Mr. Sadr from Shias. This is a town that's almost entirely Shia, and a lot of them show a lot more deference to the hierarchy, the leadership, particularly of Ayatollah al-Sistani, who has all along cautioned for a calmer, more sedate approach in dealing with the Americans. Not necessarily cooperation, but at least not armed conflict. So they are in many ways irritated, sometimes angry with the Mehdi army. And, you know, frankly, there have been a lot of reports of Mehdi army mortars falling on private homes. There was a mortar that fell upon the Al-Hakim hospital, where a lot of the wounded were being brought in by the by ambulances from the areas of fighting. It's not confirmed that particular mortar came from the Mahdi army, but that's where the blame usually lies. The people we're talking to are not all that happy with the direction, and they would like to see some more political accommodation.
And yet tonight, a new call for a national uprising and clearly some response. Scott Baldoff, thank you very much for joining us. Be safe there.
Thank you.
Scott Baldoff is Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from Najaf in Iraq. After studying the results from presidential elections between 1916 and 1996, Yale economist Ray Fair has devised an equation to calculate which candidate will win the popular vote, and it's all science. Inflation and GDP are part of the equation. Likeability is not. Dr. Fair has also come up with statistical analysis to predict everything from a good vintage of wine to a given person's propensity for infidelity. This hour, On Point, predicting the future by the numbers, running the data to see what will happen tomorrow, next month, and what will happen on November 2nd. Are you ready to believe that science can predict the fuzzy stuff, like who will be unfaithful in marriage, which year's Bordeaux will be great, who will win the White House? Are we less autonomous actors than we think? Are we just walking bundles of statistical likelihood? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Dr. Ray Fair, economics professor at Yale. His new book is Predicting Presidential Elections and Other Things. Dr. Fair, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you.
So you've put a bold, popular face on a book with a lot of econometrics inside. And caught a lot of attention in the process, kind of social scientist coming out here and saying we can use numbers to predict things that ordinary people may have a great kind of visceral interest in.
Yeah, I tried to write a popular science book where in this case the science is social science, and in process of doing that to explain one of the key methods that's used in much of social science, which is sometimes called regression analysis. And so it was an attempt to try to give people a little deeper understanding of what social scientists do and both the strengths and weaknesses of the approach.
And you take it all the way down to a prediction in this year's presidential election. We'll hold that for a moment. I want to walk into it slowly. Some of the things seem comparatively simple here, though I'm sure not necessarily to someone with a vineyard. But let's take what seems like a more simple example. You're using this process to predict which years will produce great wines. There are not too many variables in the theory or equation you bring to this. How do you go about that, just for starters?
Yeah, this, by the way, is work that's done by Orly Ashenfelter, who's an economist at Princeton.
Okay.
I just took his work and explained it used it in the book. But the theory is quite simple, is that the weather in the harvest year has an effect on the quality of the wine, and Orley managed to gather data on three key weather variables in France and used the weather variables to estimate the quality of the wine. And actually, it does a reasonably good job of predicting what the wine will be. You don't know how good the wine is going to be until many years later, but knowing the weather and using this regression approach, you can actually do fairly well in predicting how the wine will turn out.
So pretty simple, not too many factors, average temperature, total rainfall, rainfall the previous season, and voila, how consistent was the formula in coming up with years that were pronounced extraordinary years?
It was actually quite good. I then used Orley's equation to predict some of the future data that he didn't have at the time. And it does a reasonably good job in predicting the quality of the wine ahead of time. So it's actually kind of an interesting example of
right.
how you can find regularities in the data that seem to do well in predicting the future as well.
And that one seems pretty straightforward. Take us into one that seems about as complicated as could be. That is, who's going to be faithful or unfaithful in marriage? You've laid out a kind of equation for predicting that. How?
Yeah, that's a little more complicated. One of the key questions in that is whether high-wage people are more likely or less likely to spend time in an affair. The data I had was survey data from Red Book and from Psychology Today. And, of course, most people don't have an affair, spend any time at all. So we're really focusing on the 25% to 30% or so who do. And the question there is, do high-wage people, again, spend more or less time than otherwise in an affair? And the economic theory is ambiguous about this, because if you consider a high-wage person, they tend to have high income, so they tend to spend more time in all activities, leisure activities, including time spent in the affair if they're having one.
Okay.
On the other hand, a high-wage person also has a high opportunity cost of not working. So the time spent in an affair for a high-wage person is high because that person could be working and earning more. So there's a substitution effect toward working, which means you spend less time in the affair, and there's an income effect that means you would spend more time in the affair. And so the theory is ambiguous. The results suggested that there is that income has a slight positive effect on this, so it would appear the income effect dominates, that high-wage people have a slightly more tendency to spend time in the affair than low-wage people.
I want to come back and look at that after a break in a minute here, because it sets us up to think about politics and presidential politics and presidential politics this year in particular. But overall, Ray Fair, the point you're making here is that the future is more predictable than we imagine, that social science is more precise than it's given credit for. What's the meta message in predicting presidential elections?
Well, the technique that we use to try to explain behavior can then be used, once we've had an explanation, to make predictions of the future. So in that sense, it's a method that has quite considerable use. On the other hand, there are pitfalls, I call them, or weaknesses of this method, too. There's a certain assumptions that one has to make, which we can talk about in a few minutes, that means that you can't just use this blindly and think that it's a magic wand that will always predict correctly. But it's a powerful method used in widely in social sciences to explain behavior and then in some cases to try to predict it.
We're going to come back and look at the factors that come into play in Ray Fair's prediction of extramarital affairs. And then we'll move on to politics, presidential politics, and this year's campaign. We're talking tonight about predicting the future the scientific way, who you'll sleep with, what your grades will be, and who will win the presidential election of November 2nd. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you ready to believe that science can predict the fuzzy stuff, like who will be unfaithful in marriage, which year's Beaujolais will be great, who will win the White House? Can we feed data into a computer and have the future come out the other end? Or does life defy calculation? Does it defy scientific prediction? You can join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about running the data to see what will happen tomorrow, what will happen next month, next year, what will happen on November 2nd. My guest tonight is Ray Fair, economics professor at Yale University and author of the new book, Predicting Presidential Elections and Other Things. You can join the conversation tonight. Are we less autonomous actors than we think? Are we just walking bundles of statistical likelihood? Where do you rank on the infidelity propensity index? Does Ray Fair have your number? And what do you think? Do you want to see the future calculated, or do you want to fly by instinct, by gut? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got to get to politics, but I want to understand the system a little better, and the infidelity question is one of these complex ones. You spoke to the issue of income or a high wage rate, but that's not the only factor that you brought into your calculations here, Ray Fair. Describe the others for us.
Yeah, the survey data that I used had data on the age of the person, the length of marriage, an estimate or a question of how happily the marriage was, and then a question of how religious the person was. So those variables all were used along with income to try to see if you could explain the time spent in the affair to the extent that they spent any time at all.
And how did you nail down whether or not you got it right, whether or not your formula was accurate?
Well, there are ways, which I try to explain in the book, there are ways of testing whether each of these variables is what we call significant. Does it really belong in the equation? Does it actually explain anything? And so you can use this method to make those kinds of tests. So you can, for example, test whether income really does belong. Is it significant? And the variables I just mentioned were, in fact, highly significant in helping explain the affairs. It's not that I can explain any one person, remember. I'm doing this for an entire sample of people, but I can try to give proclivities. If somebody is unhappily married, not very religious, have been married a long time, et cetera, and a high income, they're more likely than otherwise. So you can make tendencies, but I can't point to any one person and say, this is what you're going to have an affair.
But you've got the proclivity there, and then you turn to politics. You've looked at elections from 1916 to 1996. And how do you go about finding the factors, finding the sort of operating theory of the case that you apply to these elections to find a formula for predicting future elections?
Yeah, this is a nice example to try to teach to how social scientists use this method. The theory is quite simple, which is it's the economy stupid is basically the theory. The theory is that the economy has an effect on voting behavior, on how people vote. And so the aim is to find those economic variables that seem to have the most power in explaining vote. Vote, in my case, I'm using as the two-party share of the incumbent two-party share, vote of the two-party.
And a popular vote, not an electoral college vote.
Not electoral college vote. So it's a share of the two-party vote.
Okay.
And so that's the thing to be explained. And then you try to find economic variables and perhaps other things, if you can, that help explain the fluctuations in that share for each election. I have 22 elections altogether.
So give us the factors here. This is clearly not length of marriage and happiness in marriage.
Right.
What are the factors that you put in to the formula for predicting presidential election outcomes?
So the three economic variables that seem to work are the growth rate of the economy in the year of the election, how well the economy has done in the past, say, three quarters or so when the person walks into the voting booth.
Okay.
The inflation rate, mm-hmm. how low or high inflation is. We tend to forget inflation now perhaps somewhat, but that in the past has been quite high. Inflation is a negative in terms of how the person's feeling of the incumbent party.
Okay, right.
And then there's the final one is the number of quarters within the 15 of the administration before the election in which the growth rate has been really good. There's some evidence in psychology that people remember parts of experiments that are really good or really bad, and so the
parts of presidency.
Case,
so the more quarters they've got popping good news, the better for them.
Popping good news, right? So that seems to the number of those out of 15 seems to matter, and that's also growth rate of output. So those three economic variables.
Okay,
are
so that's
used,
the economics. It's the economy stupid side of the equation, but that's not
right.
Only economics. So give us the other variables.
Yeah, there's then some what I call incumbency variables, which we know ahead of time. One is whether the person himself or herself, perhaps in the future, we hope, is running again. So is there a person effect? There's also a duration effect. If the party's been in power for two or more times, people tend to get tired of it, according to the evidence, and that has a negative effect on
the party, not the candidate, obviously, but the party.
The party, not the candidate, mm-hmm. right. And then there's
you've got this innate preference factor here, what you just end up describing as an innate preference in the American electorate for the GOP.
And then there's a party dummy. There's no theory for this, but just other things equal. Everything else the same, the economy's the same, person either running or not the same, et cetera. Republicans have a slight bias in their favor. So the interesting thing in the current election, for example, is that President Bush has the best possible incumbency case you can have. He's a Republican running again with no negative duration effect because the Republicans have only been in power for one time.
Right.
So he has a big head start.
So this is on the non-economic side and on the economic side?
On the non-economic side, right.
On the economic side?
On the economic side, two of these three variables I mentioned are pretty good. Inflation has been low, and that's a plus for the incumbent. The growth rate this year, the economy picked up at the beginning, the middle of last year, and is continuing to grow at a fairly reasonable rate. This is output growth, by the way, not job growth, which I'm using output growth. And so that's done reasonably well. It's predicted this quarter to do reasonably well. So those are two pluses. The minus for the Republicans is the number of these good quarters is only two out of the entire 15. So he hasn't done well in the historical good news quarters.
But we can feel where this prediction's headed. But let me ask you, before we get to this November 2nd prediction this year, I mean, as a layperson looking at this, I can't help noting that you, in this presidential election business, are predicting backwards. You're predicting from the 96 election back to 1916. I mean, predicting backwards is not exactly prediction at all, is it?
No, that's explanation. Remember, what we're doing with these methods is to try to explain behavior first. Mm-hmm. You have to get an estimated equation first. So you have to explain behavior. And then if you've done a good job at that, say all the tests are passed and you have confidence that you've explained behavior pretty well, then in many cases, as in the presidential vote case, you can actually use it then to predict the future, make a real-time prediction of the future. But the way you test the theory that, say, the economy has an effect on voting behavior is to look at past data and see how well you've explained each of the election going back. But
whether
that's
it lines
not a real-time prediction.
Right, whether it lines up with those results. So now you, in the book, you actually offer a prediction for this November 2nd's outcome, and not just a winner, but you actually give a percentage of the popular vote that you think will go toward the winner. Who are you choosing? What's the percentage, and how does the case be made?
Yeah, I just mentioned, I was jumped ahead a bit, but I just mentioned that Bush has all these incumbency things going for him. Two of the three economic variables are pretty good. So the equation is predicting, given that he will get a large share of the two-party vote, about 57.5% of the two-party vote.
So 57.5%, a landslide in presidential electoral terms.
Well, maybe not quite landslide. I thought maybe 60%, but it's a big win. It's being predicted because of these things I just mentioned. So you can again take this equation, having been estimated, plug in the economy this time, and knowing the incumbency information, and then make a prediction.
And, Professor, what's your degree of confidence in this prediction?
Oh, that's a good question. So there's the average mistake an equation like this makes, or the average mistake this equation makes, is about 2.5 percentage points an election. So it's not perfect by any means. So you, on average, make an error of about 2.5 percentage points, which in a close election like 2000 means you really don't know the winner if you're predicting 50-50, because on average you got an error of 2.5.
But here you're beyond your margin of error.
I'm more than twice beyond the margin of error. So what you can say is that if the equation is correctly specified, then the probability that Bush loses given this prediction of 57.5% is very small. Very small.
We are talking tonight about predicting presidential elections and other things with Ray Fair, economist at Yale. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ray Fair, stand by. I want to bring in not a scientific voice, but a political voice, and a very well-seasoned one, to kind of test the theory of the case that's being made here. Tim Grieve joins us from Sacramento, California. He's a political writer at Salon.com and a darn good one. Tim Grieve, thanks for joining us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
So you've read about Ray Fair's magical prediction machine. I shouldn't say magical. It's science, social science, econometrics. You're following the campaign. You heard his prediction just now. It's George Bush with 57% of the popular vote. Does this whole stew of prediction, calculation, factors going into the data going in make sense to you, Tim?
Well, as a low-wage journalist married to a low-wage school teacher, I sure hope he's right. And I'm not saying he's wrong, but the theory, the numbers he's talking about for this election are certainly contrary to the polling we're seeing, and it's certainly contrary to what I think most of us would intuitively believe about the way events have played out over the last year or so.
So you feel some fidelity coming on in your marriage, but not necessarily what's nearly a landslide win for George Bush. Are you not persuaded by the elements that are being factored in here? As I read it, it's something like 20, Ray Fair, was it 20 out of 22 elections you're finding this formula would call correctly?
I think it's 18 or 19, maybe 19 out of 22.
Okay.
But that's not the right metric. I'd rather look at size of error on the vote share. That's a better measure of how well the equation is doing.
But however it does, it seems to work fairly typically. Tim Grieve, do you think there's a kind of psychological factor that science is going to miss here, or where do you sense the punky spot?
Well, the spot, the immediate spot I see is the contrast with the polls we're seeing. You know, most polls now show Kerry up by 2 or 3 percentage points. That's within the margin of error, but it's pretty consistent across the polls. A new Fox poll out today has him up by 4 points. And what's interesting about those polls is they seem to show that people have their minds made up. 80% of the people in the Fox poll today said there's no chance they're going to change their vote. So I don't know how if those people are telling the truth, I don't know how you get from that to something approaching a Bush landslide.
Ray Fair, how do you make that leap?
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that. The next thing I was going to say after I gave you if the equations correctly specified that this would be the numbers, it could be the equation is not correctly specified. That one of the things I stress in the book are these possible pitfalls. These methods do have weaknesses, and I think in this particular example, it's quite important to discuss, think about some of the weaknesses. We basically have to assume that when you make a prediction with something like this, that the future is the same as the past in a fundamental way. The structure of the thing you're looking at, in this case the voting behavior, is the same this time as it has been historically. And there's much evidence, not so much the polls, which are one thing, but there's some considerable evidence to suggest that this election, in fact, might be fundamentally different than past elections. People seem much more polarized than they have in the past. Many people think that President Bush is the worst president they've ever had in their lifetime. Bruce Springsteen is, for the first time in his life, is going to try to enter politics and try to persuade voters. So it may be an unusual situation. And if that's true, if the structure really has changed, then this econometric method is no good anymore, because it assumes, what has to assume to make predictions, that the future is like the past in a fundamental way.
You're
so
conceding.
It's an interesting case.
Yeah, it is.
We just have to wait and see. The polls, however, can be rather erratic this early in the game. So I would put less weight on polls than perhaps some of these other things.
But you're conceding a lot there, aren't you, Herr Professor, when you say that your method depends on the future being the same as the past?
That is a significant assumption that has to be made to use in social science in general. If we are going to use econometric methods to predict the future, having explained something in the past, we do have to assume there's a stability that we have captured in the historical data that continues into the future, because if there's willy-nilly behavior that is never the same in the future as in the past, then even though you've explained the past well, perhaps, you're not going to do well in predicting the future. So there has to be stability in order for this to work. And most of the time, there seems to be, at least in this voting thing, up until perhaps now, stability there. And now we don't really know until the election to see
just what's coming.
If Bush gets 48% of the vote, it would suggest there probably is some sea change of behavior, that the non-economic variables have trumped the economy in this case. If Bush gets 53, 54, 55, it's then a case in which maybe it's more or less business as usual.
So the moment feels fluxy, and yet history has a pretty powerful consistency when you look at it over great periods of time. Tim Grieve, can you imagine political reporters like yourself turning to this kind of equation and factoring it into their reporting? Or are you still more comfortable out there with shoe leather and polls and talking with future voters on the ground?
I think in a typical year, you know, 4 years ago, we might have been more comfortable with the sort of thing Professor Ferris is discussing. But, you know, it's the mother of all cliches now to say that everything changed on September 11th. And I think a lot of things did change. And yet, you know, the numbers the professor is talking about, his predictions for the outcome of this race haven't really changed since I don't know if he had predictions back to September 11th, but since January of 2003 he's had predictions, and they've remained pretty steady. And even since then, so much has changed that it's hard to imagine that you know that those numbers can be accurate if they remain steady. You know, with the war, for instance. Going as it has in Iraq.
I guess so. Ray Fair, what about that? I know you were writing these predictions, or at least some of it, in November of 2001. A lot has happened since then. You had 9/11 behind you already, but there's Afghanistan, there's Iraq, ongoing. Does that crash the party of the statistical analysis here?
Well, the equation does have a remarkable stability. If you get the economy right, your predictions of the economy are roughly right, and you know the incumbency information, which doesn't change, then the prediction of the vote doesn't change either. So even in the book, which was written two years ago now, there was a prediction of that Bush, if he ran, would get about 56 or 57% of the vote. So there is a significant stability there. Historically, what is the case that all these other things that you can think about that have an effect on voting behavior on average have an effect of about 2.5 percentage points an election. That's the average mistake or error that is made, is about 2.5%, which is kind of small, and that was what was rather remarkable about the equation in some sense, is that you can explain so much by just the incumbency and the economy, and it's about 2.5. But what Tim is suggesting now, and many others, of course, is that we're not going to see a 2.5, that there's all these things that are unusual are going to have a much bigger effect this time. And again, it's hard. You can't really test that. You just have to wait and see.
We'll be looking at just that. Tim Grieve in Sacramento with Salon.com. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks.
We're talking tonight about predicting the future the scientific way with Ray Fair, author of the new book, Predicting Presidential Elections and Other Things. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about predicting the future, the scientific way, running the data to see what will happen tomorrow, next month, next year, November 2nd. My guest is Ray Fair, professor of economics at Yale and author of the new book, Predicting Presidential Elections and Other Things. You can join the conversation tonight. Can science, can statistics possibly account for the unexpected, for 9/11, for war in Iraq, for Jenna Bush sticking out her tongue for the cameras, for shove it? Do you want to see the future calculated, or do you want to fly by instinct, by gut? And there's this, do you see the past predicting the future, or is the future a moving target? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ray Fair says, you want to predict college grades? Well, look at who shows up for class. Strong predictor. He's also predicting the November 2nd election, and he's predicting it for George Bush by a pretty large margin. What do you think? Steve is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. Just a quick comment and a question. First thing was I read something about a college math professor who had created a model to predict how much money Hollywood movies were going to make. And it was based upon how many car crashes, how many explosions there were.
Seems to fit the model we're talking tonight.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so if there's any proof that, if you need any more proof that Hollywood is formulaic, there you go. My question is, I work as an engineer and I do a fair amount of statistical analysis on my job. And I'm wondering, how does the professor, say, qualify his output as, you know, being a good predictor or not? For example, you know, to use a techie term, what's his R squared value where he considers things to be good?
So in other words, how does he determine whether things have come to the expected or the good conclusion or not? How does he determine whether the wine is good?
Exactly. Well, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and for example, you know, going back to the presidential elections back to 1916, how many of those did he get right? That's my question.
Okay, let's look at it. Ray Fair?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways of measuring that. One is the standard error I already mentioned, the average error you make, which we call standard error in this business, which in the case of the voting equation historically is about 2.5 percentage points. You can then also use that what I discuss in the book as t-statistics to test whether each of these variables that we've mentioned, growth, inflation, et cetera, are, quote, significant. Do they really add to the explanatory power? And then you can, if you want, as you mentioned before, you can add up how many elections did I actually get right in terms of winner. And I think, as I said, there were 19 out of 22. That I don't find as useful a measure of how good the equation is as the standard error, because you're really more interested in the average size of the mistake.
Though you got some interesting ones wrong. 1960, Nixon got 49.9% of the vote. According to your theory, he should have received 51.1.
Yes, and so that's a very small error.
But a big difference for JFK.
But I got the winner wrong. Right.
Right.
When I extended this through the 2000 election, which is not in the book, but it's on my website, mm-hmm. I predicted that Gore, after the fact, would get, using the actual economic data, would get 48.9% of the vote and therefore lose. He got 50.3% of the vote and lost. So I was on the wrong side of 50, got the right
winner. Hard to factor in that Supreme Court factor there.
Right. So, but the error in that case, again, was 1.3, so it's a quite small mistake. So in terms of judging how good the equation is as opposed to who wins or loses, that was a very good election for the equation in terms of its accuracy. Et cetera.
But Steve, thanks for that call. I want to try and get a couple more in here. Paul is calling from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to ask the professor, just in line with some of the things you've been saying, given all the other factors that have played in, we have 9/11, we have a country that is evenly divided according to the president, according to some of the polls, and we have maybe 45-48% of the country who really do not like the president. And this has been like this for almost a year. All the polls show it, and we're evenly divided. And we have a little, just 10%, or maybe 7-8% of voters who could be swayed either way. And the economic factors that the professor projected really doesn't seem to be working. We're running one of the largest trade deficits right now, almost $500 billion.
So I can feel you resisting the outcome, resisting maybe the elements in the formula here. Paul, let us put it to Ray Fair. Is it possible, I guess you're saying it is, that these economic factors could be overwhelmed by a tide of sentiment, Ray Fair?
Yes, it could be the case that this has just simply been a sea change of behavior, that the Bush administration, let's say, has done such extreme things that looking at past data is not going to help us much in making predictions. And no longer is it the case that the economy is as important as it was in the past. So that's always a danger from an econometric point of view, that the structure has changed. I've discussed this before. And so it's certainly possible. It would seem right now that that is the case. If you look at the polls, the attitudes, et cetera, I agree with, you know, what's been said. It doesn't look like this is going to be business as usual, in which case, if that's true, then you don't want to put that much weight on this particular prediction of 57%.
This particular outcome. Ray Fair, I want to try and get one more call here, if I may. Rob is calling from New York City. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Professor Fair, thank you for a very interesting presentation.
My question is fairly straightforward, and it regards the effect of assessing event risk on events which were heretofore stable. And specifically, the question I have is regarding a futures exchange which was briefly traded last summer for around 4 hours and was known infamously as the terrorist futures market.
Oh, yeah.
The experimental application of experimental economics, do you think that, those techniques where people put their bet on the line, whether financially or otherwise, produces a higher degree of accuracy in predicting the outcome of such events? And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Rob, it's a great question. You will, of course, have paid attention to that, Ray Fair. If I recall correctly, it was to put up a futures exchange online with people being able to put money
right
behind their bet of when or how a terrorist attack might take place. Pretty experimental. What do you make of it?
Well, there's actually, those markets are quite interesting. You know, the main market right now, there's a futures market in President Bush versus Kerry. And if sports, I think it's called Trade Sports or In Sports, something like that. And the current price of a Bush is 53 cents. So it says Bush in those markets is actually favored, unlike the polls, is actually favored to win. Those are very interesting markets, I would say.
But it doesn't bring into account any of the kind of factors you put into your formula. You don't know what an individual investor is.
It takes into account everything. It's like the stock market. All the information that people have
mm-hmm.
is used to buy and sell Bushes, in this case, Bush futures. And so all the information is there, and you factor all that in. At the moment, the market says that Bush is going to win, but the probability is pretty low. It's 53%.
So the terrorist futures market, if you could wave a magic wand, would you put it back up as an indicator?
Well,
it was taken down because it was considered distasteful.
Yeah, but I think that's a little extreme probably because of many reasons. But the market for these Bush futures or Kerry futures is actually a straightforward market. It's just like the stock market. And it's very interesting to watch. For example, the jobs data are going to be released tomorrow morning at 8:30 Eastern time.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch the futures market for Bush, if the jobs variable comes out to be much higher than expected, my guess is the price of a Bush will go up. And if it comes down much lower than expected, it will go down, just like the futures stock market at the same time will do that, S&P futures. So it's a kind of an interesting way to see at the moment what the money is betting on. These markets typically are pretty good. The sports betting markets on football, et cetera, do a pretty good job in explaining the actual outcome. So they're interesting markets to watch and perhaps have more information in them than a simple poll.
Well, we'll get to test the November 2nd prediction very soon. Interesting to watch over time whether years from now, if this becomes more widely diffused, the entire future seems more predictable than it does right now. Ray Fair, you've got us thinking. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Yeah, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Ray Fair, economics professor at Yale University and author of the new Predicting Presidential Elections and Other Things. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the SEC punishes Halliburton, but not former CEO, Vice President Dick Cheney. This is On Point. This week, the Securities and Exchange Commission fined the Halliburton Company $7.5 million for secretly changing its accounting practices when Vice President Dick Cheney was the company's chief executive. The unannounced changes made Halliburton's 1998 annual earnings look a whopping 46% higher than they would have otherwise, said the SEC. But the SEC said that's not legal. Now, Cheney served as CEO of Halliburton from 1995 to 2000, and though the SEC did not charge Cheney in the case, questions remain about the vice president's knowledge of and involvement in Halliburton's business practices during his tenure there. For more on this story, we go to New York. James Surowiecki writes the financial page for The New Yorker magazine. His most recent book is The Wisdom of Crowds. James Surowiecki, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
So we're still scratching our heads just a little bit about this, and I hope you'll walk into it with us. Here we've got a not insubstantial fine on a very, very prominent company right now, the Halliburton Company. but not a finger laid on Vice President Dick Cheney, who was CEO at Halliburton quite recently and was there during this time. Does that add up to you? Looking across the whole spectrum of corporate scandal cases, does it just make sense that Dick Cheney wouldn't be involved in this ruling?
Well, I think there are two distinct things to think about. The first question is it plausible that this accounting change would have been made and Cheney not known about it? That, it seems to me, is a stretch. I find it very hard to believe. If you sort of imagine it, I mean, if you were CEO of a company and all of a sudden your accountant effectively came to you and said, you know, our profit is up 46%.
That gets your attention.
Yeah, you would probably notice it. But the second question about, you know, the SEC holding him responsible, the truth is the SEC held no one responsible in the company, with the exception, I think, of the controller. And he just got one of these cease and desist letters. I mean, he didn't either admit or, you know, it's one of these I don't admit or deny what happened, and I think he paid a $50,000 fine.
Was it maybe the chief financial officer, Robert Muchmore?
I think Halliburton called him controller, but
okay.
That was basically the thing,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Halliburton itself, the fine was actually not for the transgression, the accounting change. It was actually for not cooperating with the investigation. So I think what this really points up is, well, there are two things. One is the incredible complexity and difficulty that even the SEC has in, you know, bringing these cases, essentially, and sort of, you know, pushing them to the limit. So that's why you get a lot of settlements of this sort. The second thing is sort of more broadly that, again, although, you know, there's no evidence one way or the other, it just is yet another brick in the wall of sort of questionable accounting, questionable decisions that Cheney's been involved in over the years.
I mean, because Halliburton did change, without announcing it, change its accounting procedures in a fashion that was a clear change that bumped its profits up 46%. That's an enormous rise. I mean, can you imagine out at the country club, the other CEOs sitting around talking among themselves about the possibility of CEO Dick Cheney not knowing what happened there?
Right. No, I think it seems implausible. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is that it was not exactly the accounting change per se that was the problem. What Halliburton changed its accounting to was a perfectly acceptable way of accounting for, as it happened, it had to do with how they accounted for cost overruns.
But its investors, for example,
right,
might have liked to know about that,
right,
change.
That's the key, is that they did not tell investors. And that is pretty clearly a case of, deception / fraud. And the real concern is that if you were an investor and you were either holding Halliburton stock or you were thinking about buying it, and you had this change or suddenly made the company look a lot better, then, you know, that's something you would have liked to have known. And the second thing to keep in mind is also that this happened at a specific time. It happened at a moment when Halliburton was thinking about buying, I think was in the process of acquiring Dresser, which was another company was interested in acquiring.
Big company, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, keeping its stock price up was important there in terms of you know, just saving money in terms of the acquisition. So it all looks part like much of what happened in the 90s. And then, you know, today there was more news, well, I don't know if it was today or yesterday, that the SEC is also investigating Halliburton for the possibility that it bribed, that it handed out bribes in Nigeria during the late 90s.
So maybe more to come. Also, Dick Cheney's time. We're out of time with that, but we couldn't walk away from that piece of news this week without just noting the implausibility factor. James Sawicki, thanks for helping us take a look.
Thanks for having us on. Thanks, Tom.
James Sawicki with The New Yorker Magazine, his most recent book, The Wisdom of Crowds. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.